Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we're going to have a terrific show with speeches by Phil Donahue, Naomi Klein, and Seymour Hersh when they were speaking here in Urbana in May 2005. Terrific talks. You're going to enjoy them. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
On June 23rd, by a 2-1 margin, the House of Representatives voted to restore federal funding to public broadcasting. Most individual public radio and TV stations stood to lose hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, and many actively lobbied their audiences to contact Congress. The backlash among the public itself over this issue has been positively enormous. In the last week alone, petitions containing more than 1.1 million signatures from people furious about the attack on public broadcasting flooded Washington, D.C. Democrat Representative Ed Markey of Massachusetts says the message came through loud and clear, and the fact that more than 80 Republicans also voted to reinstate money for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting demonstrates that the service it helps provide is widely respected and cost-effective.
It's only $2 per person per year to keep public television on the air. Your cable bill for one channel would be that for a week, for a month, much less this entire network for the whole year.
The House vote is not a complete resolution. Some $100 million in cuts remain on the table, including money to support children's programming and assist public radio and TV stations make the transition from analog to digital. Veteran PBS journalist Bill Moyer says now it's time for public broadcasters across the country to take a good hard look at what they do and how they do it. And, just maybe, they can move forward from this crisis to imbue the word public in public broadcasting with some real meaning.
Too many of us consider our audiences to be audiences and not a public. We too look at out on the country and see a society of passive spectators instead of potential activists. I mean, we have settled in public broadcasting into a comfortable, complacent niche where we provide information that isn't necessarily the truth.
Meanwhile, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting itself has a new president. As expected, it is Patricia DeStacy Harrison, former chair of the Republican National Committee, star GOP fundraiser, and propagandist for the State Department. CPB Chairman Kenneth Tomlinson fast-tracked the search and hiring process. 16 senators have since called for Tomlinson's ouster. The Senate's expected to take up the subject of public broadcast funding next month.
Preliminary negotiations have begun on an effort to overhaul the Telecommunications Act of 1996. The last revision was a bonanza for broadcast cable and phone companies, who got billions of dollars worth of spectrum for free, as well as the removal of rules prohibiting monopolistic practices within single industries. It's expected this rewrite of the rules will result in further corporate windfalls. Mark Cooper, Director of Research for the Consumer Federation of America, says a major component to any Telecommunications Act of 2006 will be the sale of more spectrum to the highest bidder.
Congress needs money, so they want to sell your free speech rights to buy bombs. They're selling the right to use the airwaves to fill the deficit.
Content producers, most notably the movie and music industries, are also expected to lobby heavily for draconian changes to copyright laws that would restrict or even forbid a person from copying digital content. Republican Senator John Ensign of Nevada has been designated the point man for drafting a Telecom Act overhaul. A rough draft could be in circulation by as early as mid-July. Cooper says in 1996 there was no public discussion about rewriting the law. This time, citizen mobilization must begin now.
Create a committee of correspondents. Get 50 of your friends who start emailing their congresspeople and their senators and representatives about what not to do with this legislation or what to do with this legislation.
For the record, Senator Ensign is up for re-election in 2006 and has already raised more than $1.3 million for his campaign. The telecom sector, which includes phone giants AT&T, SBC, and Sprint, is Ensign's second largest business backer, collectively donating about $250,000 to his war chest.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Our first talk today on Media Matters is going to be by Phil Donahue, the legendary icon of daytime television, talking about freedom of the press in the United States today in the age of corporate consolidation. Phil Donahue needs no introduction to our listeners. I think you'll enjoy the talk. Sit back, relax, and enjoy it.
Well, thank you. I will begin by doing what I do better than anyone else on earth, talk about myself. I graduated from the University of Notre Dame in 1957. That means that this December, I will turn 70. And thank you. I think I feel that I've made an achievement. In 1959, I was 22 years old, and I got a job at WABJ radio station in Adrian, Michigan, as the news director. I was the news director because I was the only person in the news department. I had an Orelco tape recorder with vacuum tubes, long before solid-state technology. And it was a suitcase and a microphone that said WABJ on it. And I could stop. I was 22. I looked 12, and I could stop the mayor in the middle of the hallway. I began to appreciate the power of journalism. I was amazed at how powerful I was. And the opportunity I had at WABJ, I don't remember how many watts, probably 500. I don't think it was a proverbial 250 watt. I was amazed. I covered City Hall, the City Commission. I remember getting thrown out, the heady experience of being thrown out of a commissioner's office because he didn't like my question. I played softball with the cops so I could cultivate my sources. I covered my first murder. I covered the prosecutor's office. This was a fabulous opportunity to learn how a city works, how journalism works. I got stories wrong, and I was humiliated for what happened. I wrote the stories, and I broadcast them on the radio. And my station announced the Friday night football, high school football scores. There are no such radio stations like this anymore. These radio stations are now computers at which place nobody works. They beam canned, pureed music prepared at another location through the computer to the local market. This is the opposite of localism. You can't get the Friday night score of the high school football game. How many radio stations are broadcasting that now? There are several students in our assembly here. You will not have this AAA opportunity to try and make your way to the big leagues. No such farm teams exist anymore for you. So we have to ask ourselves, how many young people are having the opportunity I had to get wet, get immersed, cover the cops, cover the prosecutor's office, report a scandal? We had the cops, apparently we had 10 cops and only three of them could hit the target. Forget the middle of the target. I mean, this was just the beginning of my experience with news and what it meant and how powerful and how important it was to the community and to the culture, to the nation in which I live. Now, you know, it used to be, how many could you own? One company. Now, we have one company owning more than 1,200 radio stations, most of them computers. Then Phil Donahue became a newsman in Dayton, Ohio. I really moved up big time. Boy, I tell you what, I had a cameraman, and we just covered everything that moved. And I'd run to the fire, and I'd say, what'd it look like when you got here, Chief? And the chief say, well, it looked like a fire, dummy. What do you think it was? And suddenly, in the early 60s, talk radio hit. You could actually call a radio station and be on the air. Well, what an opportunity was this. And I arranged to have the telephone company give me the equipment that allowed me to have other people, guests from long distance. So you didn't have to come to Dayton to be on Conversation Piece, 1 to 2:30 in the afternoon, WHIO AM radio, Dayton, Ohio. I had Bobby Kennedy. I had Marguerite Oswald. I had some huge people because they didn't have to come to Dayton to be on. And I could connect these 20th century political figures with housewives in Dayton, mostly the audience then, who would call in to Conversation Piece. And the ratings went through the roof. Dayton, Ohio had never heard anything like this before. And I was asked to do the same thing on television. And in 1967, the Donahue Show, Phil Donahue Show, was born. Two cameras, women seated on folding chairs, very little budget, no band, no desk, no couch, no announcer who laughed at my jokes. We were a visually boring television program. And we were up against Monty Hall, who was giving $5,000 to a woman dressed like a chicken salad sandwich on Let's Make a Deal. And we knew in order to make this fly, we had to have issues. Issues is the only thing that's going to save us. And so we booked Madeline Murray O'Hare, the atheist. There's no God, there's no heaven, there's no hell. When you die, you go in the ground, and you biodegrade, and the worms eat you, and that's the nature of life on Earth as we know it today. Well, my dear, the whole town came down on the Donahue Show, and everybody in town knew that there was a new television program on WHIO at that time. And we inherited an audience from the preceding show. And the women in the audience, mostly women then, were asking better questions than the host. So one day I just did the genius thing of jumping out of the chair and walking into the audience, and women were standing up and asking some fabulous questions and proving that they cared more, and the sexism was very, very large then, huge. Women only cared about covered dishes and needlepoint, housewives. I mean, you can't imagine the bias that existed in television management land at that time, as evidenced by the programming that surrounded us. It was all game shows and soap operas. That's all there was on daytime television. Here comes Donahue with Madeline Murray O'Hare. And then we put our first OBGYN on. Holy cow, the phones just smoked with women. And the pill had recently been introduced. And I found myself sitting there. We couldn't get to the questions fast enough. Why am I bloating? Why is the pill making me feel this way? I would sit there while a woman would go on and on with the doctor talking about an itch. And suddenly, everybody in Dayton was talking about the Donahue Show. And our first full year on the air was 1968. Bobby Martin, Chicago. And I had a platform
for discussion with my name on it. This should happen to everybody. We had a woman on whose daughter was a student at Yellow Springs Antioch College, who was arrested at a Vietnam War protest and was fasting in the Greene County Jail, and the women in the audience were hysterical at this mother. What if she dies? And the mother would say, why aren't you concerned about the 300 young men coming home from this war in Southeast Asia in body bags every week? And it was, those were the numbers then. A week, 300, 350 a week. And then the other woman at the other side of the audience would scream at this woman, and I remember this is the day before the wireless mic. I mean, really, I feel like Father Time. And, you know, getting from one end of the studio to the other, you know, the wire would go across a lady in the front row. And the women in the audience would be screaming at each other. And then Jane Fonda came on the Donahue Show, literally, with a tie-dye T-shirt and a lot of young kids who, you know, one of whom said, man, I got some great weed here, dude. You want to, really, these were the flower children. But they were people with a conscience. And women were calling Jane Fonda and saying, why does she do this? She's embarrassing her father. And why doesn't she go back to Hollywood and just be a good girl and act in movies and shut up and sing? And Bob Evans, the farm sausage guy, wrote a letter and it said, I will not sponsor any programs that tear down America. Very simple for Bob Evans. Shut up. Stop protesting. Stop the dissent. The problem at the time, and he canceled, our luck was that we had become an 800-pound gorilla. Our ratings were sensational. They didn't know what to do with us. We put people on who criticized General Motors. We got away with everything. We did have stations that canceled, that would not. I remember a station in Arizona owned by Gene Autry would not carry a Donahue show that featured Dick Gregory. These are some of the strange things along the way. But if Peoria canceled, I was still on the air in Indianapolis. It was the honest way to come up. No one vice president of a network could cancel me while he was shaving in the morning. We built it the honest way, brick by brick, market by market. And if somebody got fed up with us, we could go across the street and sell the program to the other competing station. A fabulous democratic way to grow a television program. And so after 29 years and over 6,000 shows, and if you think I'm bragging, I am. By the way, of those in that time, the most oft-visited guest, the most oft-featured guest, was Ralph Nader, who, by the way, drew a very large crowd for me. I paid no price for featuring Ralph Nader. People wanted to hear what he had to say. I mean, Ralph Nader talked about the second crash. Your children are eggs rattling around in the crate of these cars with dashboards that have protrusions that will knock the eye socket out. And this doesn't have to be. You can have a car that's safe in the second crash. And I lived with him throughout the latter part of the 20th century as he begged Detroit to put in seatbelts. And they resisted, and they resisted, and they resisted, and they hated them. And now, seatbelts are a feature of the advertising of automobiles. They help sell cars. And most recently, to bring my odyssey to a close, I went back to cable television because I just couldn't believe. Well, I couldn't believe the cable media support for this war. You're looking at a real naive guy. I mean, first of all, I'm spoiled. I had all those years of pretty much doing whatever I wanted to do. I mean, really, it was just a wonderful, wonderful time. I would wish it on anybody I love. It's an education not available at any university. And then, so I go back to MSNBC thinking, what a great idea. I'm different. We will feature dissent. This is America. Well, by the time the troops were rolling into Baghdad, we were gone. And I want you to know that often, first of all, MSNBC languished, continues to, but it was very, really struggling then. And we weren't Elvis. We did not burn the town down. We were nowhere near the power that we had with my syndicated daytime program. But we often led that network. We were often the highest number of MSNBC in the evening. The New York Times has reported this, so this isn't Donahue bragging. I want to say again, we didn't kill them, but we certainly, the numbers did not warrant our cancellation. They warranted support and promotion and nourishing. We could have been the tent pole for the evening schedule. And it became clear that a memo was leaked, and the New York Times published the memo, which essentially a consultant said, Donahue's anti-war stance will not survive, cannot possibly do anything for you against the flag waving of the competition. Progressive dissent and anti-war people are not good for business. It is not possible to overstate the fear that corporate media has of being identified as liberal. This is very, if we don't understand this, then we really aren't ever going to get anywhere changing this. The president of CNN, Walter Isaacson, on the occasion of his being named, ran to Washington to call on Newt Gingrich and Tom DeBlay and essentially said, we're not liberal. We're not liberal. They are terrified. Liberals, I mean, did you ever talk to a liberal? Liberals, this is management's view. Liberals are wimps. They don't like war. They're not patriotic. They don't support the troops. Liberals are for unions. Unions. Do you have any idea how much the president of General Electric wants to promote a union? Liberals are for gay people. Liberals are wimps. And if they think we're liberal, they're not going to watch us. And not only that, if we support unions, unions are going to want more pay, and that's going to reduce our bottom line, and our stock will fall. The first thing we think about when we wake up in the morning, the price of our stock. So I don't see how, and it's, by the way, this same dynamic obtains to politics. We'll never, ever take money and corporate power out of politics as long as we have only two parties. Because all they have to do is shower both horses. They're a win-win situation. Which is why I was on Nader's bus in 2000. We said that all across this country. We said that why does the New York Times own the Boston Globe? These markets aren't large enough to support their own paper. Why does the Chicago Tribune or the Los Angeles Times? Come on. We want more competition. That's the reason for the First Amendment. The whole point of the First Amendment is you have a whole bunch of people gathering the news. Therefore, you have a large crowd, and you're more likely in the collective middle of this crowd to somewhere find the truth. Today, that large crowd, that collective middle, is made up of fewer and fewer companies, larger and larger in scope, much more concerned about the price of their stock than they are about the inelegant, unpopular behavior of sticking their nose under the tent to see what the righteous, powerful people of the state are planning for us. Here we are, the freest nation on earth, and the nation with a media that literally beat the drums for this war. Literally. Bum-pa-dum-pa-dum, countdown, Iraq. Bum-pa-dum. I mean, your heart started to beat. And a week ago, I visited in the home of a 25-year-old Army specialist who took the bullet in Sadr City in March of 2003, which entered in his clavicle, the part not covered by his Teflar, by his flak jacket, and came down and transected the T4 section of his spine. He is paralyzed from just below the nipples down. And that night, I saw this wonderful, this laughter at the White House correspondents' dinner. Laura Bush was so funny. She was. That was a hell of a comedic riff. But I'm sorry, I looked at these people laughing. And you begin to see the separation of the powerful and the media, who have so little time for the people in the streets and fawn over the grandees in the suites. And maybe that's why we've had such a very difficult time to get this nation to think about what it has done with an unconstitutional, unaffordable, underfunded, undermanned, unnecessary, unwinnable war. And a nation that is so largely sitting here mute, watching the bombs drop on crowded cities at night, where old people and children are sleeping. And America is sitting here watching this. And so I'm joining. It's so much of a play. It's so great for me to be surrounded by people who agree with me. Really, this is an emotional experience for me. And I thank you. And I'm pleased to pass the baton to these other thoughtful panelists. Thank you very much.
That was Phil Donahue speaking at the May 2005 conference, Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation, that was held here in Urbana, Illinois. Next up in our batting order for today's program will be a talk given at the same conference, in fact, at the exact same session as Phil Donahue, by Naomi Klein, the noted Canadian journalist and author, addressing the same subject, Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. This is a tape show. Don't try to call in. With no further ado, here is Naomi Klein.
Well, it's a wonderful honor to follow Phil Donahue. That was really fun. Thank you. I had this incredibly naive thought on September 11th, which I made the mistake of committing to print. I wrote a column that for some reason was published in the LA Times called Game Over, The End of Video Game Wars. And what the column argued was that the experience of seeing the reality of what war looks like, the corporeal reality of bodies, of terrorized faces, the rubble, in such stark contrast to the way we saw the first so-called Gulf War, that I thought it would change us, that we would never again be able to look at war as a video game again when we saw those images. And as we now know, and as we just heard, that hasn't been the case. And there was a tremendous effort to make sure that that hasn't been the case. And we've heard a lot about that last night and today. But I just wanted to add one more thing that I recently learned about, which I didn't realize during the invasion of Iraq, which is, as we all know, the Pentagon used embedded reporters. But the television networks were embedded in the war in a much deeper way than that, in that they were part of the war planning years ahead of time. I recently reread the actual strategy book, Shock and Awe, which I would suggest that that everybody read, because it talks about war essentially as a form of mass torture. It says the doctrine of shock and awe warfare clearly states that this is a military strategy that is actually a psychological strategy more than it is a military strategy. That's the awe part. The idea is that you bombard the enemy with such tremendous force that it breaks down their ability, psychological ability, to resist. They are demoralized by your awesome force. But reading this document, I found this really interesting passage, which says, the ability, it's called achieving rapid dominance. The ability to achieve rapid dominance simultaneously through the battlefield will create strategic shock and awe on the opposing forces, their leadership, and society. When the video results of these attacks are broadcast real-time worldwide on CNN, the positive impact on coalition support and negative impact on potential threat support can be decisive, which is simply to say that if the first attack on Iraq was the first time a war played out in real time, this invasion reflected an understanding that the playing out of the war in real time could be embedded on a macro level in the war planning, so that the idea was to incorporate the 24-hour news networks into the strategy so that they are projecting these incredibly demoralizing images on the people who are being bombed and breaking down their ability to resist. So we're talking about something much deeper than individual embedding of reporters, but the embedding of the entire news cycle in the war itself. And I think that explains some of those drums of war on a whole other level. I am always struck by the willingness of the cheerleaders of rampant, or what the French call savage capitalism, to break the basic rules of capitalism, i.e. The profit motive, in their suppression of political views. And I think that we sometimes tell ourselves that they won't do that, and we look at somebody like Michael Moore and say, you know, if somebody is popular enough, they will get out there. But I don't think we should be that sanguine about it. I think that there is a tremendous willingness to block out even very, very popular voices because of the broader capitalist incentive to keep these voices out, as we've just heard. I want to just make sure I say one thing constructive, and I usually try to save that for the end, and then I run out of time. So I think I'll say it now. Which is something that John Nichols and I were talking about last night, which is, I think that there is this tremendous potential that we feel at events like this to make media a political issue. We have the facts. We have the political support across the spectrum, as we heard from Amy last night. But I think part of the problem is that the issue is too big. Another is that it often comes off like griping. The other is just the inherent problem of the fact that we only understand, we're so hypermediated ourselves, that we really only understand how to do politics through media. You know, if you have political meetings, say, okay, well, we'll have a protest, we'll call the press, we'll get them to come. Well, what if the protest is about the press? How do we get them to come? You know, there is this built-in problem to making media a political issue. I think there's a real untapped potential out there in military families and returning soldiers, particularly now that what we're seeing is not media beating the drums of war, but a real turning point now where Iraq is turning into, or has really already turned into, one of these intractable ethnic conflicts. Who knows why these people would want to kill each other so much? We're just trying to maybe, you know, keep the peace there. Absolutely incomprehensible and tune outable. This is the way Iraq is now being covered. Yeah, maybe you hear about a blast here, a blast there, but utterly decontextualized from the narrative that we need to hold on to, which is that the United States is the instigator of this violence in Iraq. We are losing that plot. And I think that the talk of civil war is very, very dangerous because it implies that this is an internal Iraqi conflict, not a conflict that was instigated by an external invasion, an occupation. We need to hold on to the narrative, and we need to not let this become yet another incomprehensible so-called ethnic conflict or civil war that is so eminently tune-outable. And this really is a crucial point. And I think that the most powerful people to speak to this are the parents of soldiers in Iraq who turn on CNN to find out whether they're, you know, to try to get news desperately of what's going on in Iraq and are bombarded with the Michael Jackson trial. I mean, can you imagine anything worse? Or soldiers who come back and they want to know about their friends who are still there, who were there thinking that they were making a sacrifice that their country actually cared about, and then find out that they're more interested in the Pope's funeral or Terry Schiavo. These are the people who can speak to this very, very powerfully and with a tremendous moral force. And I think we should think about how to build those bridges and how to build a campaign of returning soldiers and military families saying, tell us the truth about the war. Because there's a way in which it's much harder to tune them out than it is to tune many of us out. So that's my little pitch at constructiveness. I'm going to talk a little bit about this new experience that I've had over the past couple of years, which is abandoning the world of print for a little while and trying to make a documentary film. I made a documentary film with my partner, Avi Lewis, called The Take, in Argentina, and it's about workers who occupy their factory and turn it into a workers' cooperative. It's part of a very large movement in that country. 200 factories have been occupied and turned into cooperatives in this way, spreading very quickly across Latin America. And it's really the sequel to, you know, we see glimpses of really an incredible democratic movement sweeping that continent. Not a U.S.-managed, color-coded democratic revolution, but masses of people in Argentina, in Bolivia, in Brazil, now Ecuador, throwing out their neoliberal governments and demanding a deeper kind of democracy that includes economic rights as well as the right to cast a ballot. These aren't movements against democracy. They are demanding a deeper and more meaningful kind of democracy than they got when their countries made a negotiated transition from dictatorship to democracy that included inheriting the debts of their dictators and shackling them to International Monetary Fund and World Bank austerity measures, which I have to say, with all due respect for Seymour Hersh last night, when he said that the World Bank, at least they don't kill people, they kill people. They kill people, and we see it very clearly in that continent, and that's precisely what is being rejected. So in Argentina, they had this incredible movement where they threw out 5 presidents in 3 weeks, but they didn't have anybody to propose. It looked like a revolution. It smelled like a revolution. There was tear gas in the air, and there were millions of people in the streets. They were storming the presidential palace, and there were helicopters. terms of, you know, carrying presidents. It looked like a revolution. But unlike, say, the Velvet Revolution, where they were like, okay, let's put our guy in power, they didn't have a guy. And they didn't have a political party that they were proposing. In fact, their slogan was, all of them must go. And it worked. So they go through five presidents. This is in December 2001. So for obvious reasons, it didn't make merit too much coverage in this country. But it was an amazing moment. And so they go through five presidents, and then they look at each other and go, well, what are we going to do now? And so there was this explosion of grassroots democracy where, when I arrived in Buenos Aires shortly after this, or in the midst of this uprising, you'd walk around Buenos Aires at night, and there would be meetings of people on every other street corner, in every plaza, in every park, clusters of 200, 300 people voting about what they were going to do to fix the immediate problems in their neighborhood. Most of these meetings were dominated by women who were dealing with very concrete issues. But they were also starting to develop a political program. And that's where the Occupied Factory Movement, that's where it grew out of. We decided to document this process of what would happen, what would be proposed in the rubble of this failed model, out of a feeling that the journalistic drive to just pile on the negative evidence wasn't really getting us anywhere. Seymour Hersh last night said, the truth is bad enough. And we actually have a tremendous amount of indictable evidence, impeachable evidence. And I think that we still feel as journalists that we have to just go out and get more of it. And I don't think that we're confronting deeply enough the psychology behind what makes change possible. There is a point at which so much bad news, so much evidence of corruption, so much evidence of violence, when it is combined with these shows of outrageous impunity, i.e. there is a total severing of causality between the exposing of corruption and any kind of political accountability or change, in fact, quite the opposite. You have these shows of, I can do anything. I can appoint Alberto Gonzalez to be the attorney general. I can, you know, let the Marine off the hook who was caught on video shooting a prisoner and apparently shot three of them dead in that mosque in Fallujah. Last week, that guy got off. Sanchez got off for Abu Ghraib, even though he signed a memo allowing the use of dogs, signed his name to it on September 14th, 2003. And they did an absurd investigation into the shooting death of Nicola Calipari, the Italian security agent who was traveling with Giuliana Screna, such an absurd investigation that even the lackey Italian government had to say, we can't sign our name to this. It's ridiculous, because they exonerated all of them. At this point, the impunity that we're seeing is really part of the show. It's, we can get away with anything. So in that context, just giving more bad news, I don't believe is a catalyzing. I think it's important, don't get me wrong, but I don't think it is always catalyzing. There has to be, we have to also be telling stories about how change happens, which I think particularly for my generation and younger is a really mysterious process. We are so hyper-mediated that we see change now in these video moments that is, you know, the wall falls, and then communism collapses. And we see it on TV. That's the story. That's our understanding of how communism collapsed. Wall falls, Burger King, MTV flag, communism collapse. And we see this in this narrative about bringing democracy to the Middle East. It's sometimes called the tsunami effect, the idea that there can be a managed media moment. Saddam's statue will fall. That will be our Berlin Wall. Then the people of the Middle East will see this on television, except not on Al Jazeera, because we'll close that down. And And we won't have to organize or do any of the messy work of political change. It will be a completely media-managed tsunami where everybody at the same time will get the same idea, and this mysterious process of change will take place. So what we wanted to do with our documentary was sort of counterbalance this by showing change happen. The real nitty-gritty of, okay, how are these factories being transformed from capitalist factories that were bankrupt, where everybody was laid off, into democratically run, worker-managed, viable business cooperatives? How does this happen? So we followed it at absolutely every stage, through the court process, through the very first meetings, through the fights with police, through the tense meetings, through people at home with their families and all the tensions at home. And the idea was not to say you can do this exact thing where you live, but to demystify change. And what we see when we show the film is that we're starting to see with documentary films, particularly when they're shown in theaters, that it's starting to have some of the consciousness-raising role that I think Phil Donahue just described, that television has been able to play in the past, but has really abdicated. Now we have Oprah, who just tells people to buy stuff, doesn't tell people to, you know, call their congressperson, but harnesses that same power to buy some new cosmetic or whatever. Documentary film is for the moment filling this gap, where it's not just that we're going to the movie theater to find out what we're not hearing, what we're not seeing on the news. That's happening too. It's almost hearkening back to the early newsreels, where people would go to the cinema to find out about the war. I mean, that was sort of what happened with Fahrenheit. But it's also that people are enjoying the process of gathering together. We've had the experience of showing our film on television. It was commissioned by Public Television in Canada, by the CBC. And that was nice, and it was kind of funny to have an occupied factory, a film about an occupied factory intercut with car commercials. And people said, you know, we saw it, we liked it, but we much preferred the experience of showing it publicly and having discussions afterwards, because it immediately turned into, why aren't we occupying abandoned buildings? Why aren't we, and turning it into affordable housing? Why aren't we occupying unused land and turning it into community gardens? The spirit, the sort of slogan of the movement in Argentina is occupy, resist, produce, and that can happen anywhere, and it can be retrofitted to all kinds of contexts, and it is being. So that experience of gathering together and watching and then acting, watching, talking, acting, is an incredibly powerful combination. And it can work on television, particularly in the context of talk shows where you have a kind of a town hall context. And I think that's part of the reason why instead of that, we now have extreme makeover reality television shows, and the narrative is the exact opposite. It's not, let's talk about your life and what we can do about it. It's everything about you and your life sucks. That's our starting premise. We're throwing it all out. Let's go to the closet. Let's bulldoze your house and start from scratch. Very different message. There's a power in stories. This is where I'll end. There's a power in stories, and it's a power to show us how to make change, but it's also a power to heal us from shock. Therapists call it narrative therapy. It's completely accepted that if you have been through a traumatic event, either directly or vicariously, that really the only treatment for it is to tell a story, is to put it in the context of a story that makes sense to you. And at its most basic level, that is what we in journalism do. We talk about what we do as stories. Write a story, did you read the story? But in fact, they aren't stories. They don't use any of the real methods of storytelling anymore. You don't actually meet people. You don't actually have a narrative arc. You just have information thrown at you. That power, I believe, is one of the most powerful tools that we can reclaim, the art of storytelling. Because that isn't about speaking truth to power. It's about speaking to one another and about our lives and making sense of our lives. Because when we are sane, we are powerful. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here on WILL AM 580. That was Naomi Klein, that you've been listening to, giving her speech at the May 2005 Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation Conference here in Urbana, Illinois. For the balance of our show and the few minutes we have left, we want to share with you the comments made by Seymour Hersh at the exact same conference that morning on Wednesday. Brief comments he made on the state of the free press in the United States today. So with no further ado, here comes Seymour Hersh.
My rock and roll pal here has got a point that we should emphasize. The book I just did on Abu Ghraib was published by HarperCollins, which is owned by Murdoch, and it is bottom line. And I have this fantasy with these bottom line companies, as Linda was saying. I think eventually what might happen is maybe, you know, the Tribune, or certainly maybe the New York Times company eventually will spin off its news division. That might be a good idea. You know, it's becoming significantly less and less important to them as they go along, as they do all this other stuff. But what Orville was talking about and what my rock and roll pen reminded me we do need something different. I don't know how we're going to get to it. And Orville, you didn't have much of an answer either, because we need, you know, whether it's going to be somebody's going to set up a trust fund in Nevada, maybe. But I remember, in the heyday of the good times, this is how we always do wine in our profession. We are professional winers, sort of like in the Army. We always wine. In the heyday in 74 or 5, I'd done Mealy, and Wilbur and Bernstein had done Watergate, and then the New York Times had been terribly, really negligent on Watergate because Henry Kissinger used to assure us. Henry Kissinger, who, by the way, lies like most people breathe, had assured the New York Times. He kept on telling, well, yeah, but you know something? I wish we had a Kissinger now running the government, because at least we know somewhere somebody has some scheme up there, some thought, instead of this mad ideology that runs, pervades our government, which is going to lead us who knows where. At least Kissinger, it was always for the oil or for the Israelis or some game, or maybe even a private company he had on the side, but we don't have that now anyway. But in any case, so by 74 and 70, I was assigned by Abe Rosenthal to be the catch-up guy in Watergate. So in 73 and 74, I began to cook on the cover-up, and Woodward and I and Bernstein and I became friends. And one day in late 74, we had a night with Jan Wenner. And this time it's still functioning, but then in 74, 75, 76, Rolling Stone really was in a profound social a commentator and a great influence on the young kids. It was the John Stewart of its generation. And so we did this night of, I guess you could call it extreme partying, sort of like extreme skiing with him. And Wilbur absolutely, I must tell you, abstained. At the high point of all this, we got this great idea. What if Hersh, Woodward, and Bernstein got together? This is 74, 75. And we'd all been hot on Watergate, and I'd done the stuff in Vietnam. What if we set up a public company, sold public shares, and announced a publicly financed investigation into the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which was the big issue in 73, 74, 75, sort of, it still lingers, but it was huge 30 years ago. You know, who really killed John F. Kennedy, and was Oswald alone? Nobody believed the Warren Commission. There's still these doubts, but, you know, time has pushed it in the background. Time and other horrible events. And so the idea was, by the time we all stopped freaking out, we were convinced it was good for $40 or $50 million in public. We were going to sell it for $10 or $20 a share. The public could join in. We were going to set up a trust. Everybody was going to buy stock. The Rolling Stone would publish it. But the public would underwrite an independent investigation. And we knew it would be enormous, you know, because the names we all had then, it would just be huge. In the morning I woke up and said, no way. And I don't know what the other guys did, but I said no way, and I wasn't going to do it. I went back to my little tedious life at the New York Times. And the point being that we haven't begun to explore the other options for alternative media, and also that what we have isn't totally moribund yet. I mean, the New York Times will run a great story if you give them a great story and you can get it by. My general problem has been in 40 years of being a newspaper person, I've watched the kind of people in newspapers and magazines that move up through the ranks and become editors. I won't say this about deans. And generally, the general attitude I have is most editors are as been somebody said about me, I do believe it's true, most editors are mice training to be rats. And so that's one of the generic problems we have. That's probably just as important as corporate ownership in a way. And so you have a bunch of toadies that get promoted because that's what people like to promote, particularly in corporations. Well, yeah, unfortunately, and here we are. It's not only trade unions that don't get reported anymore. That's sort of a blasé story. Nobody reports the underclass. Nobody reports on poor people, really. Every once in a while you'll have a token story. But we have, you know, incredible problems of the gap between rich and poor. And I think what talk radio shows, I think what the Democrats have always done wrong politically is they're always telling everybody you're a victim. You can't win votes by telling people you're being victimized. And so talk radio gives people a way to get off. They can articulate what they feel and think in a way that doesn't make them victims. I'm telling you, the next person that runs for president that can figure out a way to stop calling the downtrodden victims is going to win. Nobody likes to be called a patsy. And that's all Democrats do. You're victimized by the rich and the blah, blah, blah. Yes, they are, but that isn't the way they win their vote. I don't have an answer for the other side because it involves a certain kind of a genius. I don't know who is going to hit somebody, but it doesn't involve political operators. They don't see it. Got to find a way to talk to them. And talk radio in its funny little inchoate, to use the word that Orville used, way, does articulate something. If you can find a way to get people to talk about what they're talking about in a non-judgmental, non-victim sense, you can really turn people around in this country. Admittedly, it's real easy pointing out the problem, how to do it. But I'll tell you, the next guy that wants to be president in this country better start talking about this war and quickly. And he'll be president. I'll tell you that. I worked for Gene McCarthy in 67. I joined him at the worst time. And no matter how bad it was in New Hampshire, we knew if he, and he did it to his credit. Difficult. I was talking about him earlier. That's what makes me bring it up. He stuck to the guns. He did what Bobby wouldn't do. He went out there and campaigned and took on the war. And he could have, you know, because of personality and other issues, you know, he could have gone much farther than he did. But it's there for the taking. Kerry wouldn't do it. That's why we didn't lose the election. Bush didn't win the election. We lost it to Democrats because he ran the wrong guy, wrong time, wrong place. Anyway, there we are.
Comments of Seymour Hersh as he addressed last month's conference, Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation?, held on the UIUC campus in Urbana. To hear past programs or to find out more about Media Matters, visit our website, will.uiuc.edu.
My name is Ron Yates, Dean of the College of Communications here at the University of Illinois. When I moved here in 1997, it didn't take me long to realize what a magnificent resource WILL is for the campus and the community. If you feel as I do that WILL is an indispensable part of our community, I hope you'll join me in supporting the station. Thank you.
Call now, 217-244-9455, to contribute to WILL, Urbana.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with isolated showers and thunderstorms, the high in the mid-90s with southeast winds around 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with isolated showers and thunderstorms in the evening, then mostly clear after midnight, the low around 70 with light and variable winds. Tomorrow, partly sunny with the high in the mid-90s and light and variable winds, becoming southeast around 10 miles per hour in the afternoon. It's 2 p.m. A Prairie Home Companion is next.